Welcome to CSIS. I'm Bonnie Glaser. I'm a senior advisor for Asia in the Freeman Chair for China Studies at CSIS. And we're very pleased to be holding this book launch today. It really is a privilege because this is really a terrific volume and gives us an opportunity to talk about some of the deeper issues that are presented by China's rise. Chinese foreign policy is a topic, I think, of growing attention and interest around the globe. Some see China as increasingly self-confident, assertive, and even confrontational and aggressive, especially towards its neighbors. Others portray China as insecure, reactive, and defensive. How should we understand China's foreign policy, behavior, and objectives? Does Beijing have a grand strategy? Will China challenge U.S. interests and seek to alter the post-World War II international system in significant ways? I think these questions are hotly debated, and along with them, of course, how the United States should respond to a rising China. Today, we will discuss China's foreign policy, or more specifically, China's search for security, which is the title of an important new book by Andrew Nathan and Andrew Scobell. The authors examine China's security problems from the Chinese perspective. That is, they put themselves in Beijing's shoes in an effort to analyze how Chinese policymakers have attempted to address their security problems. So we're going to start with remarks from the two Andrews, and we will take their findings as a jumping-off point to discuss U.S. policy toward China. To help start that discussion, we will have commentary first by Professor Mike Lampton and then by Randy Shriver. And then we will take questions from the floor. And at the close of the event, copies of the book will be on sale in the rear of the room, and the authors will be available briefly to sign them. So let me start introduce our speakers. Professor Andrew Nathan is class of 1919, Professor Political Science at Columbia University. Andrew Scobell is senior political scientist at the RAND Corporation, both co-authors of China's Search for Security. Professor Mike Lampton is George and Sadie Hyman Professor of China Studies and Director of the China Program at the School of Advanced International Studies at Johns Hopkins University. And finally, Randall Shriver is founding partner of Armitage International, and I think is a director or president of Project 2049?
President.
Okay. Always want to get those titles right. Sometimes in Chinese they don't translate too well, but we know what they mean in English. All right, terrific. So we will start first with Professor Andrew Nathan.
Thank you, Bonnie. And thanks, Mike and Randy, for participating in the panel and to all of you for coming out. I said to Bonnie, when I came in here, she never does anything small. This is a very big and distinguished turnout, and we're really honored. The only thing is, by praising the book right up front, she gave away all her leverage, so now I'm not afraid anymore of the Bonnie threat. So I teach a course in Chinese foreign policy, and I talk to public audiences from time to time, and in the United States, as you all know, there's a lot of concern about China's rise and what it portends for American interests. And so the distinctive contribution that we're trying to make in this book is to turn it around a little bit for American audiences and to ask them to look at what China's perspective is on international relations, what security threats the Chinese policymakers see out there in the world, and how they evaluate their own possibilities and options with respect to the U.S. and the rest of the world, and what their strategies might be. In other words, it's a Beijing eye view of China's rise. And we orient the analysis around the idea of four rings of security. And when I teach the course, I try to ask the students to keep in mind the comparisons and contrasts with the strategic situation of the United States. So Chinese policymakers, the first ring of security for them is the internal ring, security in the territory of the PRC itself, including chiefly the territory that Beijing already controls. But we also consider the first ring to include territory to which Beijing has a claim that hasn't yet been realized, like Taiwan and even the South and East China Sea territorial claims. These are all parts of the internal security agenda. And if you think about the U.S. barely has an internal security agenda. It certainly, we have immigration issues, terrorism issues. But when you compare that to the Chinese internal security agenda, theirs is very huge. They have the question of an unconsolidated control over Tibet and over Xinjiang, which are two, as you know, vast and strategically crucial territories. They have the problem of the doubtful loyalty of the ethnic Korean population to the PRC and the strong loyalty of parts of that population to Korean ethnic identification. They have the problem of the separate Taiwan political entity that they don't control. And even in the Han, ethnic Han heartland of China, the control of the regime over the society is constantly being challenged and requires a tremendous investment not only of police resources but even of formal military resources, so that the Chinese military, the formal uniformed People's Liberation Army, performs important internal security roles within that first ring and cannot devote all of its energy to issues at and beyond the Chinese borders. The second ring of Chinese security is the 24 states immediately contiguous to China, either on land or on sea. And you compare that again to the United States, where we have two countries, Mexico and Canada, neither one of which presents a security threat to the United States. In the case of China, the countries that they have to deal with around their periphery include such, you know, monsters as Russia, Japan, Korea, Vietnam, India, Pakistan, Afghanistan, and the three of the five Central Asian stands. And all of these countries present, you know, real serious security challenges for China of one kind or another. And if we're used to thinking now of all of those borders as relatively peaceful and stable, that's only because Chinese diplomacy has put out so much effort to try to manage those relationships, so that an example like this Shanghai Cooperation Organization and the management of relations with the stands and with Russia has been a success story thanks to a huge investment. But over the long run, these are still countries that present permanent security issues for China. That China fought wars with Russia, with Korea, with Japan, I mean, within, you know, memory, within the last 100, or in most cases even more recently, with Vietnam, with India. So these are all long-term problems. They can be managed, but they don't go away. The third ring that we talk about in the book, when Chinese policymakers look beyond the immediate periphery, is what we call the six regional systems, so that out beyond the immediate neighboring countries are other countries that don't border directly on China, but which nonetheless are part of the complicated regional relationships that China has to deal with when it tries to deal with its immediate neighbors. So that, for example, in Southeast Asia, the countries that border directly on China by land or by water would include, you know, for example, Burma, Thailand, Vietnam, and Laos. But then there's Cambodia in the mix, which is not a directly bordering country. And at sea, for example, Indonesia is in the mix. And the 10 ASEAN states form a problem area for Chinese diplomacy because they insist on multilateral diplomacy. Looking out beyond in the direction of Oceania, you have the competition with Taiwan over the Oceania mini-states. You have the Australian alliance with the United States. In South Asia, India directly borders in Pakistan, but then Sri Lanka is part of that mix. And so, in other words, their immediate border is not just one by one by one country, but in each case involves complicated regional calculations that entail Chinese security. And then the fourth ring of Chinese security is the rest of the world. Of course, China is a big country, and its immediate third and fourth rings are very big as well, so that the total sort of regional power picture for China is already a big hunk of the surface of the globe. And yet at the same time, there are all these other regions farther beyond Africa, the Middle East, and Latin America in particular, where in the last 15 or so years, China has begun to accumulate important security interests as well. But those interests are, for the time being and into the foreseeable future, essentially economic. That is, they have to do with getting control over commodities, energy resources, commodities, copper, timber, soybeans, and all kinds of other resources that China needs to keep its economy going, as well as to develop markets for China to sell its products into. So that's the fourth ring. Within these four rings, there are two themes that constantly impact on the thinking of Chinese security policymakers. The first theme is the U.S. Everywhere that China looks in the all four of the rings, they find the U.S. as a very important and often a dominating presence. So within the first ring, the U.S. is very active, telling China what laws they should adopt, how they should run their economy, giving grants to Chinese civil society organizations, training Chinese students in undergrad and graduate schools, and sending them back with, in many cases, new ideas. With our consumer economy, our globalized consumer economy impacting on the lifestyles and thinking of Chinese people, our government and our civil society telling the Chinese how they should treat the Tibet issue or the human rights issue, our market telling the Chinese that what they need to do in order to sell products here to keep their people in work, our labor rights organizations, and telling the Chinese what kind of violations they have in their factories. So our fingers are very deeply into the first ring in a way that's absolutely not symmetrical. You don't find China exerting that kind of a destabilizing influence on American society. I mean, it's if it exists, it's fairly modest. You know, there are some issues, but nothing on the same scale. Then looking around the second ring of Chinese security, again, you find the U.S. is very up close. The U.S. has formal alliances, and of course, as you know, and troops stationed in the region, in Korea, in Japan, we have big deployment in Guam. We have our troops in Okinawa. We have our informal defense relationship with Taiwan, or semi-formal, with Vietnam, with India. We have our troops in Afghanistan, our relationship with Pakistan, and so forth. We're everywhere in the second ring and in the third wing. And the Obama I'm told it's out of date, is, you know, hasn't changed that much, although it is an important signal of American intention. And yet, if you look back before the rebalancing, the U.S. has always been there. And our deployments have always been incredibly robust in the second and third rings. And then in the fourth ring, China confronts, everywhere they look, a very established presence of the U.S. and our main allies, the French, the British, the Canadians, and others, all throughout the resource economies and in general the economies and financial economies. And we have troops deployed, which China doesn't, all throughout this fourth ring, so that the Chinese feel that they're resource needs are being fulfilled in the fourth ring at the tolerance of the U.S. and its allies. The second theme that unifies China's security policy is this theme of domestic stability, domestic security, because not 100%, but some large percentage of what China does in the second, third, and fourth rings is directed back to the necessity of keeping the Chinese economy growing, so that people can be employed and so that the regime can maintain its stability. So China has a kind of regime which is, you might say, meta-unstable. The regime is stable so long as it continues to satisfy the demands of the people, but it doesn't have the kind of meta-stability that, say, the Japanese regime has, where this is a regime that hasn't performed over and over and over again for at least a decade, and there isn't any sorry to the Japanese in the room. And yet you don't find the Japanese public threatening to have a revolution or a regime change. But in China, every time anything goes wrong, there's all this talk about we're going to have a revolution, the regime is no good, the system doesn't work. And even the regime itself, the leaders say that our system needs to be rendered sustainable. It needs to be changed in order to be sustainable. So these are the two obsessions of Chinese foreign and security policy, are the U.S. and domestic stability. And as Andrew and I developed in our foreign affairs article, there's a link between these two obsessions because the Chinese deeply believe, Chinese strategic thinkers profoundly believe that the U.S. intends to destabilize the Chinese system somehow or another using whatever methods might work. Although I think that we don't believe in that, you know, that this, that I think U.S. strategy actually doesn't aim to destabilize the Chinese regime. This is a kind of complicated question, and U.S. strategy is always very hard to figure out because nobody knows, nobody makes a strategy and nobody keeps one. Nobody knows what it is. But I mean, I think it's kind of ambivalent. But we would like to see the Chinese regime change and evolve. But we have, the U.S. has a very, very big strategic interest in something like stability in China. So I think Chinese misunderstand some of the complexities and ambivalences of U.S. strategy. So these are the two concerns, I think, that drive it. At the same time, paradoxically, I think the new regime that's come in sees itself as in a relatively strong position now, given these vulnerabilities, given these very, very deep problems that the Chinese system faces. Nonetheless, the policymakers feel that this is a better time in history than in the past for China to take advantage of in order to consolidate advantages and to move the ball ahead in terms of these security agendas. And I think the new regime has come in to power. It's not like an American system, as all of you know, where the new leaders run against the old leaders and say, I'm going to change everything. It's a situation in which the change is built in a kind of continuous manner on the foundation of the changes that went before. So I think the Xi Jinping group has been brought in by the old leadership precisely to do some things that are now possible to do. And I see three priorities there. This is not in the book, so it's just my opinion, and Andrew hasn't necessarily signed in blood to all of these points. But one is, I think they feel that the state role, and these are not surprising things, they're things, and this is how it works, that have been talked about a lot for a long, long time, and even started under the previous administration. One is to gradually continue the move toward reducing the role of the state enterprises and policy loans in the state banks and to give more and more room gradually to private economy and to welcome overseas private investment as well to an increasing degree. A second goal of the new leadership is what I would call re-legitimation. They know as well and better than we do that the old arguments about legitimacy, Chinese-style socialism, harmonious society, and so forth, that nobody believes those things. And I think when Xi Jinping talks about the Chinese dream, part of it is a theme is that we're not going to talk about socialism or anything that's ideological anymore. The Chinese dream is a non-ideological thing that everybody can rally around. And the third thing I think they believe is that this is a good moment for China to be more assertive, and it's not new, as I say, it's already been there, but to continue the trend toward more assertiveness in about what they've been calling core national interests. And I think they think that although the U.S. is still a great superpower and has tremendous assets, the U.S. lacks will, and the allies of the U.S. lack will. Bonnie, I saw that Bonnie said something like this about the South China Sea and the Nelson Report, so I'm stealing her idea, you know? Whenever she says something, She tells me to stop, I'm going to stop. So
it doesn't say stop.
But I'm at the end. So, you know, I think they believe this is a good time to create friction and that the other side will gradually respond by moving, you know, by yielding more to Chinese interests, and that the first thing you do when you have interests is to make it very clear to the other side what they are. The other people may not understand what they are. So I see that as the flavor for the next 10 years. And I believe I should stop there and have my co-author pick it up.
Okay.
Okay. Thank you, Bonnie. And now we've established there's no Bonnie threat. I want to establish the, or clarify the China threat, at least on the military side. No, seriously, I want to do two things. One, comment about how I characterize how we think China threatens the U.S. militarily or U.S. interests militarily, and then make a modest policy suggestion, which isn't in the book but follows. I'm sure Andy agrees with me, and it's a logical continuation of the argument we make, I think, in the book. People want to bang the China threat drum, and if we take the military side of things, China's military threat to U.S. Interests is fairly modest and fairly limited, and use those words purposefully, but really we're talking about the Western Pacific, where U.S. assets, U.S. bases in the Western Pacific are what are immediately at threat. That's not to say China doesn't have a handful of nuclear-tipped missiles that they can fire at us, but largely the threat is confined to the Western Pacific. And when people talk about the China's military threat, it's not really accurate to do count all the beans, you know, do the bean counting and say, aha, that's what they can throw at the U.S. Because the PLA, it has multiple missions, multiple responsibilities, and as we argue in an excerpt from a book in the Washington Quarterly, the PLA is overstretched. Now, of course, you say that to a Pentagon audience and they kind of laugh or snicker at you because the response is, the PLA thinks they're overstretched? Ha! They don't know what overstretched is. But the point is that there are, we're talking about two very different militaries with very different missions. The U.S. military mission set are global, and responsibilities are global. The PLA is still fundamentally a national military with primarily missions within China and on the periphery. And they're only beginning to think about and scratch the surface of missions outside of what we've called the Third Ring. So I think that's important to note. Mentioned a couple of factors that I think inhibit the China's military threat to its neighbors and to the United States, and one of those is a domestic drag, what I call it, we call the domestic drag. The PLA is not the only entity charged with domestic security, internal security. It has an important backup role, and that's taken very, very seriously. And if you look at the deployment of the PLA, it's largely around major cities in the Han heartland. If you look at how many men and women are in uniform, it's way too many to implement a strategy or a pursue a, you know, a military a limited war under conditions of informatization. That kind of warfighting scenario does not require 2.25 million in uniform. Why are 70% of those 2.25 million in the ground forces? You know, it's because largely because of that domestic backup security mission, and secondly, because it still is pretty much a defensive force to defend, involved in territorial defense. It's also stretched a very thin, approximately 14,000 miles of land borders, about 9,000 miles of coastline, this is a big area, a big border for the PLA. And again, it's not the PLA is not the only force charged with territorial defense, but that's an important part of its mission. In addition, you have what we call mission creep writ large. Since 2008, Taiwan Strait tensions have not completely dissipated, but they dramatically lowered. Up until 2008 or so, the driving scenario for the PLA modernization and force development was a Taiwan scenario. And that was very helpful for the PLA. Today, the PLA is searching to find itself again. It's being pulled many, many different ways. There are a lot of heightened expectations about what the PLA can do, not just in combat roles, but in non-combat roles. And, you know, a hot topic in recent years in China is non-traditional security threats. The PLA is expected to have a significant role in that, and they've resurrected a term that the U.S. military thought was dead and buried long ago, MUTWA, military operations other than war. And this is a whole series of mission sets that the PLA is expected to play, from humanitarian assistance, disaster relief, and a lot of these missions are within China. The earthquake, Wenchuan earthquake, snow blizzards, you name it. The PLA is expected to play a role, and even beyond China's shores in non-combatant evacuations. Yes, the PLA's role in the evacuation of Chinese citizens from Libya was fairly modest by U.S. standards, but it was involved, and it was a significant step forward. And I think the expectation will be in coming years that when there's instability in a country, whether it's on China's borders or halfway around the world, when Chinese citizens are at risk, they will expect their government to help them. And so all these are just, there's a lot, in short, there's a lot on the PLA's plate. The next, moving beyond that, I want to say a few words about policy recommendation for the Obama administration, and it's a pretty modest one. But in our book, we suggest that we advocate an equilibrium, a new equilibrium between the U.S. and China, and we argue that there are important common interests that the U.S. and China share. From peace and stability, global trade, economic prosperity. Nobody wants a war, right? But how do we move forward to develop those common interests, given that I think, and I suspect most people, everyone on the panel would agree, but we'll soon find out, that is that there is a deep reservoir of mutual distrust between the two countries. And how do you bridge that? It's it's not about happy talk. It's not about engagement for engagement's sake. How do you move beyond that? And if you talk about the rings 1, 2, and 3 from China, Beijing is very sensitive about that. Feels very vulnerable, as Andy mentioned. They see the U.S. as threatening, as playing in all those rings, especially in domestic stability and the second and third rings. We want to engage, especially in the third ring, and what's hitting the headlines lately is tensions in the so-called near seas, the South China Sea, the East China Sea. We want to lessen tensions. We want to set up protocols and standard operating procedures so that we can avoid conflict, avoid ships or planes that go bump in the night or in the daytime, for that matter. But it's very hard to develop that because China is extremely sensitive in those areas. So we certainly shouldn't ignore that. We certainly shouldn't. I don't think the U.S. should. We're definitely not arguing the U.S. should back off and concede anything to China. But realistically, where can we engage China and build trust? I think it's in that fourth ring, and it's already happening. The anti-piracy mission in the Gulf of Aden and other things we can point to. That's where the opportunities are for us to try and build a bridge across this sea of distrust and suspicion. All right, on that optimistic note, I will stop. Thank you.
Okay, thank you both very much. We'll now turn to our commentators, and first we'll have Professor Mike Lampton.
Well, thank you, Bonnie, and thank you, everybody, and thank you to Andes for writing a great book. I think this volume will appeal not only to professionals, but also be very useful in the classroom, and as was your last book, The Great Wall and the Empty Fortress. There are several things I like about the book, and there's no but that follows after this list. So, in any case, but just to call attention to it, first of all, it examines all of Chinese foreign policy. At least it tries to give a total view over the entire communist period, and indeed has some background. Secondly, and very attractively to me, and I find it great in the classroom, but more to the point, great for understanding, it places China in its geographic setting and its regional setting. I often feel a lot of us would behave similarly to the Chinese if we're located on the same piece of real estate that they are on, and I think that's a very strong part of the book. I think also it deals, although I would have liked a little more of the domestic determinants of foreign policy, could have gone further in that direction in my view, but certainly, and a lot of the domestic politics was on Tibet, Xinjiang, and so on, that aspect, but certainly makes the point that domestic politics influences foreign policy. I think it gives very balanced assessments of military spending debate. I think you used the two times factor of what they acknowledge. I think there's an interesting study by Chaz Freeman and Dennis Blasco you may have seen about how you would compare more rigorously the two budgets, but I thought this was a very fair and balanced treatment. It also, Chapter 10 has a great discussion of economic interdependence. I thought that was a very nice chapter there. Also, I like the way in terms of you dealt with that second and third ring, and in particular, how preoccupied China is, and you put special emphasis on Japan, which certainly this week is something to particularly think about, but I've always felt Japan and China is the most problematic big power relationship in the whole picture, and certainly I think you could at least extract that out of the book as well. So there's a lot to admire about the book and its layout and what it would bring to students. So I think that's great. At a broader conceptual level, I was struck, and it was towards the end of the book where you talk really about two big questions, and that's what I'd kind of like to focus on. First of all, as I think both of you mentioned, the book suggests building a balance of power that includes China in that equilibrium, that balance of power. Second, it observes that already we're witnessing a multilateral arms race in Asia. So you have that train out of the station by some distance. And I think those are both important points when you begin to think about policy. And here I think the discussion gets in some measure beyond there weren't that many recommendations in the book, but I think policy really has to start where you end, and that is how do you create an equilibrium, what's destabilizing that if that's the case, and how do we put a damper on or of this already developing multilateral arms race. And I found myself wanting a bit more on each of these, but take the inclusive balance with China. How does one build an inclusive balance of power in Asia when our principal architecture is bilateral alliances that were built in a period when China was the central problem? In other words, you're talking about an inclusive security order, but preserving a skeleton that was built for a very different age. And, how are you going to bring the Chinese into that? I don't mean you. How are we going to adapt that alliance structure in a way that is inclusive if that's possible? Also, if you think about the pivot or rebalancing, and this, it's not just a military policy, it has its economic and cultural dimensions, but we need to build an inclusive economic structure in the region. And China's pushing its ASEAN plus three, which notably leaves the U.S. out. And we're pushing the TPP, which is, at this point, smaller actors. It may or may not include any of the big economic players in Asia beyond us. But the long and the short of it is, right now, we're both pushing not inclusive economic structures, but in some sense, exclusive economic structures. So I think the challenge is really to operationalize the goal you set, build inclusive economic and security structures. Easily said, more easily said than done, and my implication isn't that it's all our fault, but the point is we don't seem to be on track to do that. And so it raises the question, if it's even feasible, how would you begin to do that? Also, this week, Zbigniew Brzezinski gave what I think is a terrific talk. If you go to the website, I think it'll be on there. The U.S.-China Policy Foundation was a terrific talk, and I'll just give you my take on it, not ascribe all that to him. But basically, I understood him to say that the problem in Asia is not principally Chinese hegemonism, not the problem. The problem in Asia is clashing nationalism. And you think about Korea and Japan, or you think about Japan and China, or Philippines and China, or China and Vietnam, or India and China, India and Pakistan. These are all high nationalistic content kinds of. And the real danger for the United States, it seems to me, is getting caught between all these clashing nationalisms. So if we have a policy that's built on the problem is hegemonism in China, then I think we're going to be, going to have a solution for what may well be the wrong problem. So, in any case, I think your first specification, inclusive economic and security structures. How do you do that? And particularly in an area that's fractured, where even our allies have Japan and Korea have difficulties cooperating. So that's problem one. The other is the whole question of the. You said in the book, the Asia-Pacific is experiencing a permanent, almost routine, multilateral arms race. And I would just add to that, I think part of this is being driven by technology, particularly between China and the United States, a sort of action-reaction cycle. We're seeing this in the cyber realm, in the nuclear delivery realms, in space communications, and so forth. So there's a kind of almost independent of man's will. We're driving this thing forward, and then it spills over to China's neighbors that to lesser extent react. So how are we going to get our hands around that problem? So I want to thank you very much for identifying what I think are the central challenges we face. And I think it's incumbent on all of us to then move beyond that and say, okay, so what do we do about it? Thank you.
Great comments. Okay, let's move on to Randy Shriver.
Thank you, and Bonnie, thank you very much for the invitation. I'm quite honored to be on this panel with these luminaries, very privileged to have a chance to make these comments. Let me say up front, well done and congratulations on the book. It's really terrific. I come from a policymaker's point of view, so we're not like academics when you walk into their offices and there's books everywhere, shelves and books surround you. Policymakers just keep a few books on the shelf, and next to Richard Bush's and Jim Mann's and, of course, the late, great Nancy Tucker, this is a book that will be on my shelf because it does a tremendous job of addressing a complex topic, but in a very comprehensive way, going through all the drivers, going through all the various national interests, and none of them are easy to go through. You pick a topic, Taiwan or China-Japan relations, it requires some pretty significant explanation of the history and how we got to the point where we got and so forth. And this book just does a great job of that. So well done, and thank you for the resource that I'll be using, and I suspect many, many others. I thought I would talk a little bit about the question that was just sort of left on the table, the what we do about it. I noted that the title was U.S.-China Relations After Two Leadership Transitions. And I think it's important to remember, particularly because the U.S. is involved in all four rings, as you mentioned, because much of this is dynamic, active, reactive kind of environment, it is important to spend a little bit of time thinking about the transition that we're about to experience here. And these are important transitions. Don't be fooled just because the president is reelected that we're going to necessarily have complete continuity. I'm, of course, informed by my own experiences and recent history. I think if you want to find two very different administrations on Asia policy and on China, look no further than Bush Term 1 and Bush Term 2. When Bush Term 1, I think you had old alliance hands, the Armitage, Torkel Patterson, Jim Kelly, a very sort of outside-in approach to China policy. Term 2, very much, I think, dominated by the Treasury Department and Secretary Paulson, I think initially sort of defined and informed by Bob Zoellick's ideas, which I think was a sort of an inside-out approach, looking at the importance and the gravity of China and the importance of getting that right, and if you get that right, then basically you get the region right. So people matter. Administrations can change even in the time frame of the tenure of a president. So I think it's important to look a little bit at the transition we're going to experience here. And I think the overlay to all this, and one of my takeaways from the book, is if you do read through the drivers and you read through the interests and you start to get a sense of how China decision-making works, I think you really get to appreciate that what we're talking about in terms of our policies and our response, we're talking about impacting China on the margins. We're talking about some very powerful fundamentals that are in place. You might even say no matter who's in charge in China and who's in charge in Washington, there's a certain trajectory that I think is unfolding, driven by our respective national interests, driven by our respective environments. And so when I think about, and I think people should think about when addressing policy proposals, is to understand these fundamentals and understand that sometimes we're talking about really impacting things on the margins at best. So that's an overlay, and that comes directly from the book. But I think if you look at a second-term Obama administration, I think one of the outstanding questions is how will this pivot be sustained / implemented, and what will it look like 4 years from now, and what will be leave our allies and friends with, what sense will we leave China with? And I think this is very much to be determined. And I use pivot. I think the fact that President Obama continues to use it, despite the instructions we may get from our friends at State and DOD, the president keeps using it, so I'll use pivot. But I think there are some open questions here. And I think, number one, I already addressed one of them. People do matter. People make a difference. And I think Secretary Clinton, Assistant Secretary Kurt Campbell, in my view, they're the stars of the administration. And I wouldn't sit here in front of you and say the next team will necessarily be worse, but it's hard to imagine the next team being better in terms of Asia policy, in terms of contributing the energy, the intellect, and really the bureaucratic skills that are required to implement policies. This is a terrific team, and we hope, at least I do, that the next team has that same commitment to the so-called pivot and developing a strong regional strategy. But again, that remains to be seen. I think number two, there are real questions about resources. Now, much of the pivot doesn't require resources. You can normalize with Burma. You can have somebody else build a pier for you, extend a pier so that you can put ships there. But a good part of it does require significant resources. And I think one of the points that the book makes is at the end, part of establishing this new equilibrium, there are a couple of fundamental things that have to be secured on the U.S. side. And one of them, correct me if I'm wrong, is sustaining military predominance in the Asia-Pacific. And all the comments about the PLA notwithstanding, we still have a tyranny of time distance problem that I think requires us to have a pretty robust presence going forward. And I think that remains an open question. Now, maybe we'll get off this fiscal cliff, maybe we'll avoid sequestration, but there are real questions about what those bottom line numbers will be. And look, if the president says, I take him at his word, as we all should, that we're going to have 60% of our forces in the Asia-Pacific going forward, there's a lot of ways you can get to 60%. You can cut elsewhere, and you can do a lot of things. The bottom line number is still going to be important here, and I think that still is an open question. And that bottom line number will signal China. It will signal our friends and allies. Because the other thing about the military part of the pivot is it's not an invitation for free riding. It's actually a request that our friends and allies participate alongside us in very meaningful, consequential ways, asking our allies to undertake serious capacity building, to understand what it means to operate alongside others with a common operating picture and so forth. So there's a lot that's going to be required on the resource side. On the issue of trade, I think this is absolutely fundamental. Trade and commerce is the lifeblood of Asia, and we've been out of the game. And I hope the TPP is real. And by the way, China is not excluded from the TPP, and nobody's excluded from the TPP per se. It's not a by invitation only club, but it is a club that you have to qualify for, and you have to be willing to meet the standards of what is being proposed as a high quality trade agreement that's going to go inside borders in ways that will be very difficult for a country like China to meet. But to my knowledge, no one has ever said China's out. So I think the TPP is actually a potential vehicle for inclusion. But we have to be serious about it. This is an administration that has not initiated a single trade liberalization effort, not one. All the trade liberalization efforts were inherited from the previous administration. And I think if we're not in the game, then that calls into question this whole response to China's trajectory and China's emergence. Of course, we could face new diversions. The United States, I'm not going to say we've seen this movie before, but occasionally there's an attempt to prioritize Asia. We get the attention of our senior leaders from time to time. But then there's always a problem elsewhere in the world. The Middle East usually could be something else. But issues like Iran loom very large in that regard. There are potentially others. And again, that relates to number one. The people matter and the team matters. So there is the potential for a future diversion. And then, of course, we can't forget that this could also be overplayed and or played poorly, the effort to pivot or rebalance. And I hesitate a bit here because I think there's some growing narrative that we might be doing that already. I don't think so, and I don't buy into that. But let's also not forget that the pivot was made possible by a very strong demand signal from the region. We began hearing very loud and clear from friends and allies in the 2009-2010 timeframe that they wanted us more active, they wanted our presence, they wanted our attention, they wanted our investment. And whether or not that demand signal is maintained and sustained going forward will, I think, relate to how deft we are and how good we are at the implementation. If it's overplayed, I wouldn't use China as the criteria. They're not going to like any of this. But if our allies become uncomfortable with implementation, then that is a serious issue. So there are questions about how this second term will proceed and whether or not the pivot will be fully embraced and what it might mean in implementation. But I think I come back to one of the points that really stands out in the book. Even if we're successful and even if the administration maintains what I think is a smart policy, we're still, I think, dealing with an environment where a lot of the fundamentals that are in place sort of put us on a track for a difficult, scratchy relationship with China. And I think the language, the seeking of a new equilibrium, is interesting, but essentially that's still buying time, and that's still trying to find that's almost exploratory, how we find ways to get along and how we attempt to discover new areas of cooperation. So I think in the meantime, we do need to continue to pay attention to these operational safety issues. Crisis communication, crisis management is still a huge problem. Every time we are tested, we prove once again what a problem it is. So these need to be areas where we continue to focus. But, you know, I do wonder if we still aren't answering the big questions. And if it's a new equilibrium, if it's a attempt to manage things and muddle through, are we not addressing some of the big questions? And, you know, I think if you ask people in this town on one side of the aisle or the other, sort of the future vision for the U.S.-China relationship, or for China for that matter, you'll get a range of answers. And I think subtly we've been evolving into a position of where we think the best we can do is buy time. But it wasn't that long ago. You know, I always remind people it was the Clinton administration that talked about peaceful evolution. Well, that was a pretty clear statement of strategy that it was our view that we should be doing things to help China evolve and change their political system. That seems to be completely gone from our rhetoric and our informing our policies. It seems that we've evolved to a point, and I think a statement was made, we have this interest in stability. Surely we do. But if a near-term stability brings longer-term challenges and problems, I wonder if we should put the big questions back on the table about what kind of China we want to see and if we can reach some consensus on that. Are we doing the things today that we need to do to engender those kind of outcomes? So, thank you.
Great. Well, just to add one point to those marvelous comments and the list of things that are really excellent about the book, I really appreciated the attention that you play to the role of the United States in these four rings, because I really do believe that China is just obsessed with the United States. There isn't an issue that the Chinese face that they don't think about the U.S. role, U.S. intentions on that particular issue. And I agree with the point that you made, Andy, about China sometimes not understanding U.S. interests and U.S. strategy. You pointed out particularly that they believe that the United States seeks to destabilize China. I would add to that the worry that the United States seeks to contain China's rise. I think that these are misunderstandings of U.S. interests and U.S. strategy. But it makes me somewhat doubtful that we will be able to achieve the goal that you then both outline in your conclusion, which is, again, that the U.S. has to retain military predominance, and I assume more than in just military terms. But at the same time, we have to reassure Beijing that we seek to create a balance of common interests rather than contain China. And I wonder if that goal is really attainable, given what I see as China's just inability or maybe unwillingness to truly understand what U.S. interests and strategy are. I think that as the power gap between the U.S. and China narrows, the Chinese become more self-confident and perhaps see the United States in the final throes or the last gasp of U.S. hegemony. Now, maybe that will last many decades, but I think that the Chinese view this as a potentially sort of dangerous period because of that. But if they see U.S. weakness, then they may seek to take advantage of that. So it's a real conundrum, I think, for any U.S. policymaker going forward to try to manage China. China has been difficult to manage in the past, but I believe will be even more difficult to manage in the future. So we now have plenty of time for questions and comments. I ask that you please wait for the microphone, identify yourself, and please make your comment or question rather brief so that we can include as many as possible. Okay, and we'll start over there.
Okay, I'm Konrad Maciasz. I'm from the Polish embassy, but I'm speaking only for myself here. Thank you for your terrific presentation. And your book was supposed to be written from the eyes of the Chinese government. So it came to my mind, and this is a question. You are calling for a new equilibrium between the United States and China. The Chinese leadership have been calling for some time, I think 1 year or something like that, for a new type of relationship between two superpowers, United States and China. Do you think that it's about the same, or maybe the Chinese government and American government are looking for the same? Or maybe you would like to go back to what Zbigniew Brzeziński proposed some time ago, I think, with G2, which is a totally different thing. And the second very short question is, your recommendation is to go back, cooperation between China and United States should go concentrate on the fourth ring. I agree that some time ago, the biggest challenge to both relationship was first ring, Taiwan issue. Now I think it's second ring, the seas and so on. Don't you think it's too early and going too far to concentrate on the fourth ring cooperation, with all these unresolved and challenges and issues on the second ring? Thank you.
Thanks for a very good question. I just want to clarify, I didn't mean to suggest that we ignore other rings, but I think, you know, given China's sensitivities and the fact that they perceive the U.S. as threatening Chinese interests in the first, second, and third rings, I think the most fruitful area of cooperation is in the fourth ring. But we certainly can't ignore the other rings at our peril.
So I think Jan Barris and I are the only people here from New York. So I'm just glad after hearing Mike and Randy that you people in Washington have to solve these questions. We're not advocating yielding any core American interests to China. When I said we wrote the book from the Chinese point of view, what I mean is that we're trying to understand, as Americans writing for an American audience, trying to understand what motivates Chinese. But in the conclusion, we're advocating a U.S. policy. We're not totally not serving as spokespersons for China at all. So, I mean, I think Mike Lampton in particular put it very, very extraordinarily deep analysis of the problems. And yet my instinct is that the way forward is to do what Kurt Campbell and what Hillary Clinton have done and Obama has done, which is to stick to core American interests. We shouldn't be pursuing any American interests that aren't core American interests, but I don't think for the most part that that's been the case. I think some of the campaign rhetoric goes in that direction of just talking what we call in New York crap, I don't think we should be yielding. But however, I agree with Randy and others that this portends a long period of friction, and that's unfortunate, and that's life. But I think if you look back in history, there are some examples where through friction the U.S. and China have found a new equilibrium. I would cite a couple of examples. There are some unfortunate cases where that's not true, but there are some success stories. One is the story that is told in Evan Medeiros's book called Reluctant Restraint, in which he tells a long history of just very, very painful friction between the two sides, during the course of which China came to understand the underlying rationale for many American demands about arms control and limiting of arms sales, and came into compliance with those demands for at least for the most part, if not 100%. The percent I don't know is classified, so I don't know it. The trade negotiations which brought China into the WTO were a success story, and those things continue. The friction continues and the adjustment continues. And I would say that this will be controversial, but that the co-management by Beijing and Washington of the Taiwan issue has been a success in making that issue less, reducing dramatically the cost of war without sacrificing the interest of either the U.S. or China or Taiwan, I would say. So there are possibilities, but I don't know how to answer the question they legitimately ask, which is what is this sort of strategic vision to guide all of the steps of that.
Okay, Eric, wait for the microphone.
Hi, my name is Eric Lowe with the Fair Observer. My question is, I think I totally agree with Mr. With David Lampton's thing about like we are facing a new China, but all our policies, like all other stuff, actually are from the previous generation of containment because of the Cold War and everything, and all the dealing with Japan and Korea and everything. These things doesn't apply to a certain extent after all. So how do you change the rhetoric into a more updated version of what we are facing right now with, for example, the islands, which is something that has been left before that still need to be dealt with? And my second question is for Randy, is talking about like the free riding capacity of the situation. That happened, when NATO deal with Libya. Gates says, we haven't, the spending, the NATO hasn't been, as much as we have. So I think there is a kind of free riding on some of our allies. But I don't think that American people want to bear the brunt of the national police force of the defense spending. So I think that would be something that would be think of as well.
Well, this issue about how to cooperate seems, first of all, the issue of the fourth ring came up. I think we ought to cooperate wherever we can find opportunities. So I'm not dogmatic on which ring, how conceived we're in. If global climate change, that's beyond the fourth ring, right? So, So anyway, I'm a total opportunist in terms of where you might cooperate. So I don't think we need to be dogmatic about that. Secondly, I think we've mentioned Taiwan, and that's been, you said, co-managed. I will just say managed. And a lot of credit goes to people in Taiwan, incidentally, for this. But when was the decisive point where this became, I'd say, on the manageable track? It is when President Bush stood with Wen Jiabao and said, our friends in Taiwan are jeopardizing American interests, pushing the envelope too far. And I think that actually was, A, true and quite reassuring, and in fact, I think had some influence in Taiwan as well. So sometimes fostering cooperation with the PRC or others involves the management of your friends and your allies. And what scares me about the current situation is I think we're writing a few blank checks to people that have agendas that aren't entirely consistent with our own. So I think we'd foster some cooperation, as I would understand it. For example, when Panetta went to Tokyo, he did have some cautionary words for our Japanese friends. And I think that, so sometimes you have to, you have to deter your, I don't want to say your adversary, but you've got to deter the concern you have. But on the other hand, cooperation is fostered by sometimes exerting moderating influence over your friends. And so those would be two suggestions I'd have.
Well, I could actually spend a lot of time in a discussion with Mike about Taiwan. I'll maybe put that to the side for a moment because I was asked a question. But I did want to endorse, I guess I'm a fourth ringer. I think this is very important. And I think one of the mistakes I've seen virtually all administrations make is we have a tendency to overstate our common interests. And that sends us down a very unproductive path. And I think there, example after example, I mean, my personal favorite is the Korean Peninsula, where I think we've believed our own rhetoric and our own headlines about the extent to which we have common interests with China. I think we have common aversions, but well short of common interest, because as soon as we take a single step forward in the direction of trying to solve it, the United States and China diverge completely because we have different priorities and different interests, common aversions, but different interests. And I think if you look around the world, you see a lot of common aversions, but not necessarily common interests. But I do think in the fourth ring, we could find some. And I think it's very important, because if you look at the list of accomplishments in U.S.-China relations, U.S.-China attempts at cooperation, I think the cupboard is pretty darn bare. Pretty darn bare. And I think we need some victories. In sports, you would say you need some wins to start to build confidence. And I think in the fourth ring, you might have a better chance of finding those. And I'm for trying to build confidence and mutual trust, and I think you're probably more likely to find it there. Now that I've had my say on that, I forgot what I was asked.
About the free riding?
Oh, free riding. Well, I think the point is we need friends, allies, and others to embrace a common view and then understand that we have different roles to play. I agree with you that the American public may not want to support a huge share of the burden, but guess what? We will. But I think it becomes more acceptable if we have allies alongside us making investments and building capabilities and capacities that are complementary to ours. And I think that strengthens our hand ultimately vis-a-vis China.
Next question. In the back.
Kelly Curry from Project 2049 Institute. Thank you for a wonderful panel. I wanted to go back and ask several of the panelists who talked about this issue of peaceful evolution and the ideological or normative issues between us. And does coming to a new equilibrium mean that we accept authoritarian China into the foreseeable future, that we come to terms with China as a permanent authoritarian state, and that we have no role to play in changing that? Or do we need to I would love to hear Professor Nathan address Randy's question of, do we need to put this issue back on the table? Do we need to bring this back more in? Because it does seem to be, at the end of the day, a very destabilizing factor in our relationship, the differences and divergence between our political systems and our political values.
So I'm very active in the human rights field. I'm the board chair of Human Rights in China. I'm on the board of NED. I'm where's Sophie? Did she leave? She left before I got a chance to pledge allegiance. I'm on the Asia Advisory Committee of Human Rights Watch. U.S. society is very, very diverse. So, I mean, many of us are going to do these things because we believe in them. On the strategic U.S. government policy side of the thing, I think the U.S. has a strong interest in rule of law in China and in the international system, and that we should push that. And I don't think that the U.S. government should describe this as regime change. But the Chinese will certainly interpret it that way. But I really do support the human rights agenda as it's a rule of law agenda.
Anybody else want to comment?
Yeah, quick comment. Even if the Obama administration, as Randy rightly observed, is maybe downplayed some of our value, emphasizing American values, they're still there. They still guide our policies, and they're still appear very threatening to China's leaders. You know, soft power, we have a whole chapter on soft power in the book, and I think that's just as important or just as threatening to the Chinese communist leaders as our hard power, maybe even more so. And it's really hard to downplay that, but perhaps our choice of words, terms, might be different. Instead of maybe hammering home democracy, maybe we can talk about justice, accountable government. Maybe that might not make a difference, but I think when we talk about democracy, our U.S. officials hammer home democracy, it's interpreted in Beijing as regime change, regime change, regime change. So.
Next question, over here.
Thank you.
Steve Winters, local researcher. I heard an argument made at one of the other leading think tanks in town recently, basically went along these lines, that if you look at the economic reality, sort of the East Asian, Southeast Asian economic miracle as it's developed over the last 20 years, you have an existing system that's developed with the supply chains that you can trace, and with China as the hub of this system, and with Thailand, all these other countries feeding in with special parts, and a lot of it coordinated, for example, with the Walmart supply chains by Li Yinfeng out of Hong Kong. So the argument was, it's already a done deal. I mean, a lot of the discussion about TPP or these other things, or ASEAN Plus 3, that's really on top of something that's already an existing a powerhouse that nobody in the world can compete with for various reasons of efficiency. And it would seem to me that probably that's the way the Chinese leadership looks at it. And then just one quick other thing, although you mentioned the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, you didn't say anything about the BRICS. And I thought from the point of view of the Chinese, they're putting a lot of emphasis on that as the wave of the future, and, you know, like getting out of the dollar and doing a lot of other things. So those are two things. When I try to see how the Chinese are looking at things, that's what I see. And also the BRICS seem to cover all of those rings that you're talking about. So I don't know whether the breakdown in the rings really fits the BRICS paradigm.
I think what we probably what all of us are talking about is to further intensify all of the economic relationships that include China. So the status quo that you mentioned is not a negative from the point of view of what we're advocating. And, you know, the international economy is incredibly dynamic, and so China's current role will not be permanent. Nobody's current role is permanent. It's constantly evolving, and they face a lot of competition from other actors, which is not that we're causing it, but that's happening. And they also have to move up the value chain and, you know, not pollute the environment so much and all that kind of thing. So I don't see this embedded relationship that you're talking about as a negative. The BRICS, I think China's settled long-term strategy is to move gradually as fast as they can, which will take quite a long time, to having a global reserve currency, to the full convertibility of their currency on the global scene. But they're cautious in moving in that direction because of the vulnerabilities of the economy to currency speculation and inflation and things like that. So, you know, I think China will, and these BRICS, this is, of course, as you know, a slogan that somebody put together to refer to the dynamism of certain emerging economies, but each of them is really separate. They don't have a common policy, a common economic model, a common strategy or anything like that. And I think that their growth models will diverge. You know, Russia's an energy-based economy, which is facing threats. Nobody knows what the real growth rate of the Chinese economy is and stuff like that. So I don't worry too much about them as a strategic unit. You got to take the next question no matter what it is.
Hi, Mike Masetic with the PBS Online NewsHour. I was quite struck, even though I know it's a fact, about that the first ring is internal, but includes, from the Chinese perspective, most of the South China Sea. Doesn't that create an incredible perception difference between the way they look at the world and the way we look at the world? I mean, I know we've had the Monroe Doctrine. We even invaded Canada once. But you'd have to go back to the Polk administration to find a president that had a similar view of you know, what you consider your territory and what is somebody else's territory.
Yes. No. No, I think it's hard to disagree with you. I would just make an observation that when the Monroe Doctrine was articulated, the U.S. was not in a position to actually enforce it. And I think if China, and you actually see some writings in China that suggest that China is putting forward an equivalent, a somewhat equivalent position to the Monroe Doctrine, then they're still not in a position to fully back that up. But they're in enough of a position to cause a lot of friction and tension in the so-called near seas. But to pick up on a point that Mike Lampton made, I think quoting Zbigniew Brzezinski, that China's only part of the problem. I mean, it's a significant part of the challenge. But we're talking about, you said, clashing nationalisms. And so that we can't just point the finger at Beijing here.
Go back to the geography you continually point to. I mean, China's got a problem, broadly speaking, we never have had. And that is, the more it pushes against the interests of its periphery, the more pushback it gets. And I think China is so far away from being able to dominate its periphery, it can't even dominate its own territory fully, right? So, so in any case, I think we got to take that constraint in. The other thing I haven't really heard here, but I think is a big constraint. You mentioned, Randy, sustainability. That really means budget. That means resources. It means will, but it means that. I think China and the United States are in a funny way in the same strategic position, albeit at very different economic levels. And that is that we both need to pacify the external in some way so we can focus on reform at home. And fundamentally, I think the most influential lever, if that's the way to put it, on China is our own good performance of our system. I think all the external activity in the world, when we're mismanaging the situation at home severely, isn't going to do much. So I think you've got to make trade-offs. It isn't just what in the abstract would you want to create equilibrium in Asia, but what can we afford and at what domestic cost does that occur? And so I think our incentives to find a way to the cheapest possible equilibrium is what we ought to be looking for.
Thank you for all the speakers. My name is Linda Bova. I'm speaking just as an interested citizen here. So some time back in the Atlantic region, we had the same situation with multilateral arms race and nationalisms and things like that. So, and Pacific looks like that right now. So my question here is there any chance for a common security project led by U.S., by China, by India, by somebody else? Because that could solve some of those issues with whom to include, whom to exclude, and, who is the, real, how you call this, threat in future. Thank you.
That's kind of academic question I'll answer. So if you compare the circumstances that made it possible to have peace in Europe and to have the EU and a common European security policy and stuff like that, the sort of preconditions compared to the situation in Asia, I feel that there's a vast difference. So what made it possible to have peace in Europe? I think one thing was exhaustion from numerous wars. China's not in that position. A second thing is relative equality of the main actors, that is to say Germany and France and Britain. That's not there. Another thing is a common enemy, the Soviet Union. That's not there in Asia. Another thing is even more intense economic interdependence than exists in Asia. And a fifth factor was the forging over hundreds of years of a common culture in terms of key values, post-materialist values, things like that. And that's not there in Asia. So I think that this future, which we would all hope for, is a long way off, and it's possible in some very distant future, but the conditions are not there now.
Okay, we have.
Thank you. My name is Yoshiro Mukayama. I'm with the CSIS Japan Chair. If I may, I'd like to direct my question toward Professor Andrew Nathan. You talked about re-legitimization as one of Mr. Xi Jinping's priorities, and it seems to me that China since Jiang Zemin has relied on the narrative of nationalism, and its main target has been Japan. So my question is that do you think Mr. Xi Jinping's administration will continue to rely on this narrative, or do you think they have to find more attractive kind of narratives instead of nationalism? This is my question. Thank you.
So I think the main source of legitimation for the regime up until now has really been economic growth. And I think nationalism has been a second theme. And nationalism in any country is very complicated and multi-layered. And in China, it includes, you know, some very positive elements of pride in China and its history and culture and things like that. And but there is definitely the Japan target piece of it. And I believe that that will continue. But I'm a little bit different from, I think, Brzezinski via Lampton thing about nationalism in the following sense. I think that the deep root of these clashing nationalisms in Asia, this relates a little bit to my previous answer, really is still geostrategy. I'm still a kind of Robert Kaplan geography type. I think that Japan and China, we developed this argument in the book, and Richard Bush, he had to leave early in his book. What's the title of Richard's book on China-Japan relations? And the title has this Perils of Proximity. This is the reality of China-Japan. They're too darn close, you know? And that fact is not going to go. Two very, very big, two and three economies in the world, very big militaries, occupying so close together. So that's going to generate nationalism. It's going to generate fear of the other person. And I think that situation is there with a lot of the relations that China has with Russia, with India, with Vietnam.
Up here in front.
Hi, my name is Sharon Shin, and I work for the International Division of National Wildlife Federation, and this is just my personal question. Dr. Scobell, you just mentioned that the U.S. and China can start building trust within, like, the fourth security ring. And I'm just, like, wondering what your thoughts on, like, how U.S. and China can proceed from, say, like, building trust in the fourth ring, considering that I'm just, like, citing, like, China scholar Ken Lieberthal once said, oh, the U.S. and China have different sources of distrust. U.S.'s trust of China comes from, like, suspicion of China's future intentions, and China's distrust of the U.S. comes from its past, say, like, history of being taken advantage of by, like, industrial powers during the so-called Century of Humiliation. And also, the U.S. and China have this, like, cultural, like, difference, because Americans basically think that if we have a problem and we bundle and solve it and it's done. And the Chinese have this, like, cultural insecurity, be it a blessing or curse, that if we have a problem, it's like we always have problems. It's underlying, even though sometimes we don't perceive it. So we need to be, like, really, really cautious. And considering, like, all these factors, what do you think, like, the U.S. and China can, say, like, move beyond the fourth ring cooperation? Thank you.
Thank you for your question. It's a very good one. Let me answer it. I may not be the best answer, but I'm going to answer it this way. Now, for so many years, and still even today, China, in our book, we make the case that China, while it has a global presence, it's still fundamentally a regional power. And so it has interests all over the world. There are Chinese citizens, all over, almost in every country you can imagine. There are Chinese products, Chinese companies active all over the world. But still, fundamentally, it's still a regional power within the Asia Pacific, and because of that, and that's only happened since the 1990s. So, because of that, China has only recently discovered national interests, and talking about their their foreign policy in terms of national interests, right, core interests, et cetera, et cetera. Prior to that, the emphasis was on principles, right? The four principles of peaceful, the five principles of peaceful coexistence, the new security concept, lots of principles, mutual non-interference, you know, you name them. And China could spout those and feel good about themselves, Chinese leaders, and not ever be challenged on them. But now China is operating all over the world, and all of a sudden, its principles are being challenged. Even though it's emphasizing more interest, it still stands by claims it's following its principles. So whereas non-interference, what does that mean when you're supporting or bribing a foreign government? Or you become a target for anger and outrage in a foreign country when you're perceived as stealing jobs from local people or driving local businesses out of local entrepreneurs out of business. So the rubber meets the road now for China, and what that means is that China is now in a position to realize that it ain't so easy to be a global hegemon or a world power. And so I think that realization gradually is dawning on China's leaders, and it opens up opportunities, new opportunities for cooperation.
Just a quick couple comments. I think, first of all, I would disagree that the sources of mistrust on the U.S. side relate just to China's future. I think if you take a survey, look around the world and find a country that has three things, authoritarian, corrupt government, resources, and a bad relationship with the United States, you see China there big time, and that's Zimbabwe, Iran, Sudan, Venezuela. So these may not be global strategic issues for some, but it sure complicates the United States and our regional strategies in all these different places. But I think number two, and it relates to something I said before, we don't have a great history of success. And if you look at particular incidents, look at the accidental bombing of the embassy in Belgrade. What do the polls say in China right now about whether or not that was truly an accident or whether we did it on purpose? It's off the charts. It's like 80% or plus think that we intentionally bombed the embassy in Belgrade. If you look at the EP3, when we put in all the effort and all the work over more than a decade to create a mechanism, the Military Maritime Consultative Agreement, to deal with this very type of incident, and then the response is they don't pick up the phone, they won't take the call, they won't take the meeting, and they say we want to cancel the MMCA. So these are very corrosive interactions. And just to repeat, you know, being a fourth ringer, we need these victories because all we're getting are very corrosive interactions that reinforce these mistrust on both sides. And it's damaging and harmful because our bureaucracies absorb this. And it affects how people think, and it's very harmful over time, and we need more positive areas of cooperation wherever we might be able to find them.
Mike Fonte.
Mike Fonte, I'm the DPP's, the Democratic Progressive Party of Taiwan's liaison here in Washington. Thanks for a great presentation. It will come as no surprise that my friends don't like co-management very much. And I guess I worry a bit because I've heard equilibrium-type language being spoken of in Washington circles now for some time. And just put it on the table that the DPP wants to keep all options open for the people of Taiwan. And I worry, and I'd like to know your thoughts on this, that in the question of coming to some equilibrium that we will see China's core interest in Taiwan as acceptable and not allow the continuance of a democracy in Taiwan. That's a problem that my people certainly don't want to see. I'd like to know your thoughts on that.
I used the co-management term. Lampton tried to rescue me by saying that the people in Taiwan deserve a lot of credit too, but apparently I didn't get off the hook. The U.S. interest is in peaceful resolution, as has been said, and that the U.S. policy will, you know, I anticipate that it will, you know, continue to insist on peaceful resolution. But I see the trend of events in the Taiwan Strait as favorable to the PRC strategy. It's a long-term strategy of economic integration and weakening the, diplomatic isolation. We lay this all out in the book, and I think it's being quite successful. It doesn't necessarily spell the end of democracy in Taiwan. I'm certainly totally sympathetic to that goal. But I don't think that, but I think if peaceful resolution took place, that would be all that the U.S. would then not oppose, any outcome that was arrived at peacefully.
I think it was critically important. I'm going to let him add too, but let me just throw in a sentence or two. I think it was really critically important language when the United States proposed, and I'm fairly certain that it was Richard Bush that suggested the language, that any outcome would have to be supported by the majority of the people of Taiwan. Mm-hmm. Now, somewhere along the way, that morphed into that it requires the support of the people on both sides of the strait, because I think the people on the mainland objected because they said 1.3 billion people should have a say. Of course, if they don't have a say in choosing their leaders, I'm not so sure that they would have a say in the outcome here. But I do think it's particularly important that Taiwan is as a democracy where people do have a say, that their support is secured. So, in other words, it should not be peaceful resolution through coercion. Mm-hmm. Did you want to add anything?
I wanted to come back to two earlier things. First of all, the discussion that Andrew had of principles and interests. I've just been looking back over the last 45 years, and what strikes me in looking, the Chinese usually, by the end of a negotiation, have a very clear idea of what their interests are, what they want. I agree in the history of describing themselves, they put a lot of emphasis on principles, and only recently feel very comfortable writing about national interests. I agree. But what strikes me is underneath it, they've generally, from the Korean War, they had a set of objectives. I mean, going down the major periods here. So I think the Chinese are pretty interest-based, and I don't have any problem trying to define our interests and work. I think that provides a basis to deal. So, but I do think the Chinese generally have a good sense of their interests. On the corrosive business, the EP3 and the bombing incident, I agree it is corrosive, and it left a bad taste in a lot of mouths in the administration and elsewhere. But I think this gets to where I said I might like a little more domestic politics in the book, even though you had that. And that gets to both of these crises. It gets to the nature of the Standing Committee of the Politburo. How much influence did Zhang have? If you're going to be the president in China, pick up the phone, you better be able to answer a question. And it took him about 2 weeks before he could answer the question. Sure, he had enough support to effectively answer it. So in the same way, we always explain our activity as, well, we got a Senate and we got a House and you need a supermajority in one and, we go into this song and dance. The Chinese have their own internal politics, and maybe it's corrosive, but it's the way it is. So it's incumbent on us to, I think, each understand the institutional limits that we're under. And it was the U.S. that pushed for the hotline and all of that, and I understand all the crisis management reasons for that. But I think the Chinese were reluctant, and my guess, reluctant to do that. And one reason is, well, we got a phone now. They're going to be asking us to pick it up, So anyway, that's the kind of what I mean by domestic politics is more than just Xinjiang and Tibet.
All right, we're going to take one last question, and then we're going to go to book signing over here in front.
My name is Glenn Fukushima. I'm with the Center for American Progress. I was based in Japan until earlier this year, and I had the opportunity to talk with a lot of people in Japan as well as in other countries of Asia. I have to say that in Asia there is considerable skepticism and some confusion about the Asia pivot or the Asia rebalance. And I think for some of the reasons that Randy mentioned about the resources constraints, the personnel constraints, the fiscal problems, diversion, and so forth, I'd like to ask the panelists if they could tell us 4 years from now, at the end of the Obama administration, how we should judge the success or failure of the Asia pivot or Asia rebalance. I mean, what are the measures? What are the metrics? I mean, how do we measure success?
Go ahead. You go. No, no, no. Well, I would have seen the rebalancing pivot.
Mic on the mic.
It is. In any case, are we going to find more cooperation or less cooperation from the Chinese? And I think the jury's out on that. Are we going to find more or less cooperation with respect to Iran, with respect to Syria, with respect to the Korean Peninsula? And I will judge the and we can't attribute lack of cooperation to the pivot. There might be many other reasons. But let me put it this way. I hope that creating constraints and the attempt to shape Chinese behavior will set off an internal debate, and they'll decide they want to focus internally and push the limits less. I think that's the optimum, and that would be expressed in more cooperation than we've seen for the last 3 years on issues important to us. So I would just look and see if the zone of cooperation is enlarging or contracting. My instinct is that the Chinese don't react as positively to constraint as we might hope. And therefore, I'll have an open mind. There's a high degree of consensus behind the policy, it appears, but I'm not sure it's going to produce the result we want.
Perhaps in somewhat less diplomatic language, I would say less bullying and intimidation by China of its neighbors would also be an important measure of success. Okay, well, this has really been a terrific discussion. I hope we've all stimulated you, for those of you who have not already read the book, to want to purchase it. So we will have our authors in the back to do book signings. And.